I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and it is Friday. I know you've been waiting all week for it. The Jackpod is finally here with the one and only Jack Beatty, a.k.a. On Point News Analyst, a.k.a. the man with the unique mind that helps us connect history, literature, and politics in a way that brings clarity to the world we live in now, a.k.a. the man who is...
What Ted Koppel, Walter Cronkite, and Edward R. Murrow was to past generations.
Jack, what do you think of it?
Edward R. Murrow, for heaven's sakes, I remember him with his cigarettes. Can you remember that? Just the constant fog of cigarette smoke. I hope I don't have that. Anyway, well, thank you.
That was from Kyle Joyner in Helena, Montana. And I'm sure that he was not referring to the cloud of cigarettes in the good night and good luck phrase, but more sort of how Murrow's analysis helped us clear the fog when it came to understanding the world.
Very good. Whoa, what a pun you have there. Wonderful, wonderful.
Well, actually, but there's more. So Kyle also said this.
Jack Beatty is not only the best analyst and commentator on Point and NPR generally, but throughout the entire news media apparatus today. So when Jack speaks, I listen.
You see, Jack, you're having an impact out there.
Well, if you could see my face now, it, as my father said, the map of Ireland is all over it. It's red all through.
Okay. So again, as I've said before in past pods, Jack is not only brilliant, but he's incredibly humble. And so I'm suspecting, Jack, that you may eventually tire of the repeated adulation. But I won't. So you'll just have to live with it, Jack, okay?
Well, grin and bear.
So now onward, because today is episode 9 of the Jackpod. And what's the headline, Jack?
Unintended consequences.
This bill that we will sign today is not a revolutionary bill. It does not affect the lives of millions. It will not reshape the structure of our daily lives or really add importantly to either our wealth or our power. Yet it is still one of the most important acts of this Congress and of this administration, for it does repair a very deep and painful flaw in the fabric of American justice. It corrects a cruel and enduring wrong in the conduct of the American nation.
Jack, that's none other than Lyndon Baines Johnson. Why are you starting with him?
Yes, he was speaking on Liberty Island in the shadow of the Statue of Liberty, and he was signing the Immigration and Naturalization Act of 1965. And as he said, it corrected an enduring wrong. That would be the quota system set up by the Immigration Act of 1924, which tilted massively toward immigrants from Western Europe, such that, you know, more people from the Isle of Wight than from the whole of Poland could come, and restricted the number of immigrants drastically. And everyone who knew about it knew that it was unfair. And the new system that this act made was a first-come, first-served system, not a national quota system. And under the quota system, you know, like 200 people could come from Japan. It was that racist. And it made other changes in the law that essentially liberalized it and made immigration a fairer system.
Well, so Jack, I actually want to talk for a second, or at least outline some of those changes, because we hear a lot about them, right, in this day and age. So you're exactly right. It got rid of the national origin quota that used to exist, or quotas. And then it did something else. The 1965 Act implemented preferences for family reunification, right? Then came employment, yes. Then came refugee status. And interestingly, spouses, minor children, and parents remained what they called non-quota immigrants. And each country, I think, after 1965 had the same cap, like you're talking about, versus the variable cap. that existed before. So why are these things, or why is the 1965 Immigration and Nationality Act the subject of your headline of unintended consequences?
Because one of the unintended consequences, unforeseeable certainly then, was that that act furnished the necessary condition for the rise of Donald Trump, and beyond that, and even more worrying, for the rise of anti-democratic sentiment among conservative and Republican voters. That no one imagined that happening. But right from the start, it was clear that the prognostications, Johnson and young Ted Kennedy, who pushed it, age 33, pushed it through the Senate, they said this will not appreciably increase our population. In fact, immigration went from about 290,000 in 1965 to 1 million a year by 1989 and pretty much leveled off there. Second claim, this will not bring in low-wage workers who will compete with our more vulnerable populations. No, it did not. It had just the opposite effect. Students of inequality point to the rise of inequality in America, low wages and so on, which correlates strongly with the opening of immigration after this act. And they say it contributed to the downward pressure on wages for low-income Americans. So right away, and clearly, the forecasts for the bill went awry. What happened increasingly was that the country began to fill up with people who had not been, we hadn't imagined that immigration would take on this dimension. 5% of the country was immigrant in 1970. Today it's nearly 15%.
Mm.
And that's back almost to what it was around the turn of the century at that, you know, the peak era of immigration.
Okay. So Jack, I know that there's a continuation of your analysis that I want to get to in a second, but I've got some follow-ups just briefly on the Immigration Reform Act. Because you mentioned Ted Kennedy, right, who was 33 at the time and a newly minted senator. But what's interesting about that is throughout his legislative career, all the way until Senator Kennedy's death, he looked at the Immigration Act of 1965 as one of his greatest accomplishments, right? In order to honor his brother, the assassinated President John F. Kennedy, who had,
right.
I guess, he got the ball rolling on immigration reform. And then, in addition, from what I understand, Ted Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and even John F. Kennedy, and I'm presuming LBJ, I might be wrong, all saw the Immigration Act of 1965 in the same vein as the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Is that not right, Jack?
That is right, and it has a sort of coda to that. You know, just after signing the Civil Rights Act of 1964, President Johnson famously remarked to his aide, Bill Moyers, "There goes the South for my lifetime and your lifetime." He predicted, in short, the realignment of white voters in the South, who had been, you know, 90% Democratic from Reconstruction on, to the Republican Party. And that was the biggest unintended consequence of the Civil Rights Act. Well, the parallel here is, and the Civil Rights Act was on the side of the angels. And the parallel here is the Immigration Act, also on the side of the angels, and it had this huge unintended consequence of producing a right-wing reaction.
Okay. You know, one more thing about what happened in 64 or 65 to get the act passed and signed, because, Jack, I was sort of digging around for things that Ted Kennedy had either done or said or written at the time, and I actually bumped into this sort of article that he wrote. And in it, you know, he talks about people or groups that might have resisted, right, the liberalization of American immigration laws in the mid-60s. And here's what he said. Senator Ted Kennedy said, "During the course of hearings, I personally met with representatives from several of these organizations, including the American Coalition of Patriotic Societies, the American Legion, the Daughters of the American Revolution, and the National Association of Evangelicals. And there was a candid exchange of views between myself and those who joined the discussion because they were skeptical regarding the various reform channels and the reasons for which Kennedy gave the organizations that he believed reform was necessary. Okay, now while that might not come as a surprise, he then goes on to say that all of those groups in those meetings, however, they recognized, he says, the unworkability of the national origins quota system and expressed a willingness to cooperate in finding a new formula for the selection of immigrants. I'm wondering what you think about that, because we have parallel groups of Americans now, not uniquely, but they're rather vocal in their criticism of U.S. immigration, who, think that exactly what you're saying, that in 1965, the doors opened to essentially a flood of immigrants from abroad.
Yes. I think that is a good construction of he's putting the best face on what was a pretty strong opposition.
Yeah.
But it was you could paint a face on the opposition. A lot of it came from Dixiecrat Democratic senators who didn't want them foreigners around their around our states, and some of it came from inveterate nativist groups. And I'm afraid the American Legion answers to that. So he's putting a good face on what was a pretty stout opposition. And some of the features that went into the bill, for example, the family reunification, were put in there by opponents of the bill because I think they sensed this was a way of undermining it. So he's putting a gloss on it for sure.
I gotcha. Okay, Jack, but the unintended consequence, it may have been unintended, but it shouldn't have come as a surprise, right? Because you talked about how the early 20th century peak of immigration to the United States. None of that happened without dramatic opposition and pushback from the children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren of immigrants who were already here towards the end of the 19th century. So can you take a look at the history of, I guess, what you want to call push-pull in immigration in the United States?
Sure. Right from the start, this has been true. Push and pull are this is the way immigration experts speak about migration. And here's an example of pull. Very early on, from the 17th century comedy Eastward Ho by Ben Jonson, he's sending up the giddy enthusiasm for, quote, Virginia, Earth's only paradise. And he has this scene in a tavern where a boomer, a promoter for Virginia, is trying to sell stock in the Virginia company. And someone there says, but is there such treasure there, Captain, as I have heard? And the Captain Seagull replies, why, man, their chamber pots are pure gold. So not only the streets are made of gold in America, the chamber pots are made of gold. Who wouldn't want to go there? That's an example of the traditional pull of America. Oh, riches, a great future. The push is well illustrated in the next century, in the 18th century, in a story about Boswell and Dr. Johnson. They were touring the Highlands of Scotland, and they came. This was at the time of what was called the Highland Clearances, where the people were being forced off the land, often at bayonet point, to make way for sheep, and the people had nowhere to go. And they stopped in a village, and Johnson noticed there was a party going on. It looked like a party, a dance. First, just a couple of people dancing, man and woman, and then three or four more. And then everybody, one by one, people joined the circle of dancers to this mournful bagpipe tune, and the circle just kept bigger and bigger, bigger around an empty middle, leaving only the oldest people out. And Johnson was puzzled. What could this be? And he asked the person, would you explain what this dance is? And the person said, the dance is called America.
Mm.
People, that was push. Boswell observed a ship going to America. The people left behind there, on the mainland, bending down, falling down, and ripping out the grass with their teeth. So grief-stricken were they to lose their relatives. A Nigerian poet today, actually, I beg your pardon, a British Somali poet, Wasan Shiara, she writes what a lyric that I think captures the universality of push. She said, "No one leaves home unless home is the mouth of a shark." Mm. And all over the world, people have come to America running from the mouth of sharks. And there has been a change, though, in recent years. Pull was really sort of the dominant motive up until almost the day before yesterday. That would be the single man from Mexico, either undocumented or documented, looking for a better life. But starting around 2014, that changed. Fewer and fewer young men, now more and more families, whole families being pushed by fear of crime, by climate change and malnutrition, by malgovernment, by various forms of persecution and harassment out of the central triangle of Central America, and seeking not illegal entry into the country, but asylum. And so now asylum is the main, appealing for asylum is the main channel for this family, dry migration to the country.
Mm. Okay, so Jack, you're heading in the direction of giving us an analysis that helps explain the very serious, resistance towards immigration that we've been seeing, and it was crystallized by the Trump administration for sure, right? I mean, former President Trump and his advisors ideally would have sought to render immigration down to zero. But let me ask you something, because, you know, when you said earlier that there are economic impacts of the rise in immigration that we had since 1965, I'm not clear about whether we can come to a conclusion about whether those economic impacts are universally good or bad. Because on the one hand, for example, I'm seeing data from the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, Jack, that says for immigrants that do not have a four-year college degree, even though they make up 10% of all people, all U.S. workers right now, in some industries, they're 35 to 36% of workers, farming, fishing, forestry, things like that. And then when you look at the other end of the spectrum with immigrants that come into the country with four-year plus degrees, the amount of economic growth that they contribute to the United States far outweighs the economic growth that we see on average from Americans, native-born Americans with four-year degrees. So what I'm trying to get at here, Jack, is the unintended consequence is that due directly to the sort of fuzzy data around whether working class Americans have been negatively impacted, or what is it due to?
Well, I think that's right. It is fuzzy. And I'm citing here from an article, The Hard Truth About Immigration, by David Leonhardt of the New York Times in The Atlantic. And he writes, if the United States wants to reduce inequality, it's going to need to take an honest look at a contentious issue. Immigration. And he cites people saying, well, lower wages, is this because the people will work for nothing? There's evidence against that. But then he cites a National Academy of Science study from 2017, which says that on the whole, there has been a negative effect on people at the bottom. Whereas it's been great for, you could say it's been great for other Americans, upper middle class Americans who can get daycare from people who come from recent immigrants, who can get their lawns taken care of, who can get, you know, all sorts of things done cheaper than if they had relied on native born labor. So a mixed picture, but a picture that tends toward inequality toward the most vulnerable Americans. And this is what helped to produce the reaction. And here I'm citing an article by Larry Bartels, the Vanderbilt political scientist, in a paper that he spoke about on our program, a 2020 paper, that's really sort of crystallizes the reaction and the poisonousness of the reaction, the type of the reaction to immigration. And the paper's title is Ethnic Antagonism Erodes Republicans' Commitment to Democracy. And he points out that majorities, near majorities of Republicans now believe this: the traditional American way of life is disappearing so fast that the time may come when patriotic Americans need to take the law into our own hands. We may have to use force to save us. And they said things like, we feel like we are strangers in our own land. And they talked about in the survey data, their concerns were about, quote, the political power and claims on government resources made by immigrants, African Americans, and Latinos. Claim on government resources. We're hearing that, as our show last week brought out, even from African American voters in places like Chicago, who are seeing the city helping to deal with the influx of immigrants it's facing, asylum seekers, which is taking away resources from the African American community. And so this ethnic antagonism strongly predicts anti-democratic sentiments. The idea that maybe democracy isn't going to work, we may need a strong man, and it correlates with anti-democratic sentiment, that is, ethnic antagonism, even more strongly than it correlates with a vote for Trump, meaning that ethnic antagonism preceded Trump, and it will last beyond him.
Yeah. Okay, so Jack, I want to make a couple of observations, if I could, about what you just said. Because first of all, you're exactly right. We just did this show about how Texas Governor Greg Abbott's busing of migrants. I want to make that distinction, right? Because we're talking about people who come to the southern border undocumented. Migrants to northern cities has produced crises everywhere from New York, Chicago, et cetera. And we talked to Chicago residents in Black communities who felt that they had been historically neglected to begin with, and were resistant to having their facilities used for migrant shelters. Interestingly, though, in that hour, our guests went out of their way repeatedly to say, we're not against immigration, we're not against migration, we're just against having what little we have taken away from us. Now, the other thing, Jack, that I wanted to note is, for the sake of clarity, when we say immigration, right? I mean, that's a huge category. It includes all legal immigration. It includes temporary visas, permanent, marriage-based stuff. It includes people who eventually get their green cards, students, what have you. All legal. But then also, I think a lot of what you're talking about is resistance and antagonism towards the migrants or the undocumented, the asylum seekers do not go through the processes established in 1965 in order to come to the United States. And I want to make that distinction, Jack, because I think that's where, when you're saying that there's a draw towards criticism, of the government, whether it come from the right or now from people who consider themselves of the left, that's where it's all coalescing, isn't it? But then that requires some kind of massive reform, change, action, if not to the legal immigration process, then what the United States shall do with the number of undocumented people who approach the border, right?
Right. And of course, this is the issue that the Republican Party wants to remain an issue. They don't want that solved. The first bill that President Biden submitted to Congress was an immigration bill that called for, you know, all the usual good things, path to citizenship, employer verification, build up of a 21st century border, non-starter in the Republican Senate because they want the issue, because it drives this ethnic antagonism. And yes, the lyrics are about undocumented immigration, right? But the music is about immigrants. You just can't miss it. It's about newcomers. And right from the 90s on, there were people warning that essentially this unintended consequence of the Immigration Act could bring. And here's Samuel Huntington, a conservative, to be sure, social scientist at Harvard, warning this in the 90s. He said, if multiculturalism continues to spread, it is likely at some point to generate an ethnic and possibly racist popular reaction from white Americans. If this occurs, the United States would become isolationist and hostile toward much of the outside world. Mm. That describes the feeling state of many Republican politicians and voters.
Jack, I haven't heard Samuel Huntington's name in about 20 years. I can't believe we're having a resurrection of clash of civilizations here, but is that what you're saying?
Well, he was wrong about that. I mean, wars happen. Look at the war between Russia and Ukraine. Same civilization, you know. So that was wrong. But I think this feeling was prescient, because as I say, you know, the lyrics may be those undocumented, but the music is immigrants, and that's why people say that. Wait a minute, do all the good things go together? There's a line in Isaiah Berlin, one of his essays, saying all the good things don't go together. Can you have a fair and, you know, open immigration system on the one hand and protect American democracy on the other? Or do you need to restrict immigration, both legal and undocumented, in order to save democracy from the ethnic antagonism that is driving anti-democratic sentiment among Republicans? And you know, in the 90s, there was a commission led by the extremely prestigious Barbara Jordan, who was really one of the heroes of Watergate and who had immense moral authority. And her commission recommended a cut in immigration by a third. In other words, she was trying to deal with the unintended consequences, and they wanted to change the nature of it. She writes, the commission finds no national interest in continuing to support lesser skilled and unskilled workers to compete with the less vulnerable parts of our labor force. Mm. So she wanted, let's let doctors and lawyers who have guilds, you know, that keep out competition, let's knock down those guilds and have doctors and lawyers and journalists come into the country. But let's restrain the unskilled immigrant, because that's putting that puts our own most vulnerable people at risk. You know, she showed that it's possible to be both pro-immigrant and doubtless and doubting about the value of large-scale immigration.
But so the idea of merit-based immigration, as you're saying, from Jordan's recommendations in the 90s, it went nowhere.
Went nowhere. It was defeated. And, that was the road not taken. There could have been a change. Now, would that have been enough to tamp down the reaction to the stranger among Republican voters? We'll never know. But what was left intact was a system that I think, as I say, is the necessary condition for the rise of Trumpism. This resentment of the other. And remember, we're using in this series a metaphor from Arlie Russell Hochschild, the Berkeley social scientist, in her book *Strangers in Their Own Land*, about her research among white working class people in Louisiana, and the metaphor she has is the line, mm-hmm. and how white people in line feel that others are jumping in ahead of them. And they're waiting for their part in the American dream, and they feel, wait, African-Americans are getting ahead of us. Professional women are getting ahead of us. Now we have immigrants getting ahead of us. And we're just waiting for our shot at a better life. As she said, it's a study in grievance and mourning.
Yeah. The only last thought I'll add here, Jack, is that that feeling of being in line and having people jump ahead may not necessarily match the truth of the situation, right? Because we went through a lot of statistics in this podcast. But, of course, in politics, oftentimes people are driven by feeling and not necessarily by truth. But that actually leads me to turn back to the Jackpod's loyal listeners. And I want to ask all of you, what do you think of Jack's line that he's drawn here between the Immigration Act of 1965 and the unintended consequences he talked about regarding working class Americans, Republican voters, and that ethnic antagonism that Jack mentioned? And also, I'm curious, immigration needs reform in this country. There's near universal agreement on that. But what kinds of reforms would you like to see? So send us your thoughts on those two issues. And as always, do it through the On Point Vox Pop app. If you don't already have it, just go to wherever you get your apps and look for On Point Vox Pop and let us know what you think about today's episode. And we do absolutely listen to every single one of them, as you know by now, because, Jack, we got a lot in response to your discussion about Thomas Hobbes and the Leviathan from last week. So when we come back, Jack, we're going to take a look at what people had to say. We'll be back in a moment.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We're back. And of course, this is the Jackpod, and Jack Beatty's with us. And Jack, you know, I have yet to see the Jackpod episode that doesn't garner really passionate, interesting, and thoughtful responses. So as a reminder for folks, last week Jack talked about, in the wake of the mass shooting in Lewiston, Maine, Jack talked about the failure of the state in keeping Americans safe, right? And Jack, and you went back to Thomas Hobbes and the Leviathan, and that really struck a chord with a bunch of people. So let's start with David Maribo from Baltimore, Maryland.
The state has failed to keep the people safe because we, the people, elected them to not do so. Our governments do not sufficiently fund things such as education and job training, so poverty and crime result. Carjackings and robberies are common in my inner city neighborhood, so we may choose guns to protect ourselves from such crime. Yes, it makes us feel safer, even considering the risks Jack Beatty correctly cited. David French has defined threats from those who do not like what he has to say, so he may actually be safer with firearms. What are we supposed to do? Let ourselves be killed?
Well, here's another thought in that same vein from Damian Butler in Spokane, Washington. Here's what he said.
Listening to this podcast reinforces the idea that maybe, you know, I'm not alone in thinking that we all have to arm up, you know?
A lot of people seem to be thinking this, Jack, but here's a little bit more of what Damian had to say.
The whole idea with the elections and Trump and all the MAGA crazies, it feels like if we didn't have something to fend off from multiple people and to protect our property and our food, I just don't know. I don't want to invest any more money in firearms because I'm not a shooter. But the guy that you had on the show that's talking about how they can move out of the country, I don't have that option. And so the only thing I have to do is just stand my ground.
Jack, I find these responses from listeners, I mean, they're searingly honest, but it's so sad because it doesn't seem like or it seems like a lot of people are genuinely worried about the breakdown of American society.
Well, they're living through it.
Yeah.
Damien's comment there, I've got to stand my ground. Ooh. And of course, we know what he means, but there are also these stand my ground laws, which say that when you're menaced, you don't have to retreat. You can stand your ground and shoot somebody. But isn't that where we're headed? I mean, come on, let's be realistic. The Supreme Court in this Bruin decision of a year or so ago basically said, you know, people have a constitutional right to carry weapons in public. Mm. We're going to see more and more of that. And because people are feeling what Damien and David are both registering, the fear and the sense that they're not safe, that government isn't caring even the least bit about making them safe.
Yeah. This is where, though, I have to interject and add a pretty ironclad statistic that says that in households with firearms, the rate of injury and death is higher, significantly higher than in households without firearms, because we're talking about accidental shootings and suicide as well. So when it comes to safety, we can't have a conversation without acknowledging those truths as well. But that's not necessarily where the minds of listeners were after we talked about Hobbes and the Leviathan. Because here's another one. This is from Jason Denlinger from Dubuque, Iowa. And Jack, he wanted to tell you that last week's episode outlined exactly why he recently went to a town hall with Iowa Senator Joni Ernst. Because he'd taken his six-year-old son to the playground. They saw a gun there. It was a toy, but nevertheless, it made the fear that you talked about, Jack, it made that fear palpable in Jason's heart.
He was clutching my hand the whole time. He was scared. He was wondering how he was going to be protected, where he would be safe. And so I went to this town hall to basically not only ask Joni Ernst, but ask my fellow Iowans, because I could see that most of them were sort of on the other side of this issue. How do I protect my child? Because the government has failed to do so.
Huh. Well, Jason also told us that Senator Ernst responded by talking about mental health. Wondering if you had something to add to that, Jack.
Well, Joni Ernst, the senator you're speaking of, ranks number six in the Senate in money received from the gun lobby. So she's bought. I mean, let's just lay it out. She's bought and paid for, and her mental health comment was what the gun lobby pays her for. And Iowa, in the Iowa legislature in July 2021, passed an open carry law. So that could have been a real gun, and it would have been fine with the Iowa legislature. So fear and the organized and the corruption of organized money drive together here to make America safe for guns, and little boys in parks have got to be very careful. I mean, of course, you know, little boys in parks. Think of the case in was his name Tyree, the little boy in Cleveland who was shot dead because he had a toy gun. I mean, my God, where are we headed?
Yeah. Well, Jack, we've got truly some loyal listeners now in the first 9 episodes of the podcast. One of them is Howard Turner from Elkhart, Indiana. I think he sent his responses to at least 3 or 4 episodes of the podcast. Always thoughtful messages. This week, though, Jack, Howard actually disagrees with you.
I do not fully agree that the state has failed in its duty to keep us safe. While there are far too many mass shootings, I mean, just 18 people within the last week, there are still the majority of us who have never experienced gun violence. So the majority of the country is safe.
Now, Jack, this was very interesting, and I think Howard's exactly right, because it depends on your frame of reference, right? Mm-hmm. When it comes to even now, an American's chance of being the victim of a mass shooting, even though we have so many in number, the chances are actually still pretty small. On the other hand, I would say that if we look more broadly at gun violence, including suicide and other forms of gun violence, those numbers are pretty high, even on average in the United States. So what do you think about what Howard said?
Yes, you know, but Maine last week. All right, now there are only two states, Hawaii and North Dakota, that haven't had, quote, mass shootings. And, you know, David rightly, Howard rightly says that, you know, the vast majority isn't touched by this sort of thing. Only 5% of gun deaths result from these mass shootings. All true. Yet I've found that no less than 15 million Americans, quote, I'm quoting from a study, have had a mass shooting in their immediate neighborhood. 15 million, that's a lot of people. And we recognize that, as you say, street crime and suicide and guns in the home, these are the big contributors to gun deaths. But here's the difference. You know, inner city crime, as it's called, drug-driven crime, self-esteem-driven crime, the horrors that these young people commit against each other in their fear. We know where that's located. That has a it has a local habitation and a name. But mass shootings, they can happen anywhere. And isn't it at any time? And isn't it something that the Shannon Watts, whom we've devoted a program to, the hero of the gun control movement, the group she headed was called Everytown USA. Everytown. That's where mass shootings can happen. So that's why they're so fear-driven, that they drive so much fear, because we can't just avoid neighborhoods as we can with, quote, inner city crime. No, this comes to malls, to churches, to synagogues, to, bowling alleys.
Okay, well, we've got a couple of more here, Jack. This is Joe DeChristopher from Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. And he looks at the government as a whole, but particularly the Supreme Court, as a major part of the state's failure.
We might want to consider a constitutional amendment to more specifically define what limitations on the right to bear arms can be pursued by government. I believe that the current reading of decisions from the Supreme Court, especially the current Supreme Court, far distort the original meaning and intention of what has been determined to be a universal right to bear arms.
Well, here's Mary Fitzpatrick from Billings, Montana, and she actually sees the government as failing to protect the citizens in many more ways than simply gun violence.
Control of legislatures and executive agencies and now the courts has meant only profits for the shareholder are protected. Here in Montana, the state is fighting a judge's ruling that it must account for climate change and greenhouse gas emissions in permitting of industries. Far from protecting us, government is allowing and abetting predation by corporations. How do we arm ourselves against that?
Okay, so here's one last one, Jack, and it's another question for you. It's from Saf Fahim in New York, and here's what he asked.
Does, in fact, and simply the failure of the government to protect citizens in the area of arms constitute a categorical failure for the government and its efforts? Or is that simply a partial failure, and which can be corrected?
Answer, Jack?
I think it can be corrected. Look at smoking. I mentioned Edward R. Murrow at the beginning of the show and how he used to conduct interviews just covered in smoke. And every movie you see from the 1950s, people light up. I forget what the data was, but basically since then, since the government made limited war on the tobacco companies, smoking has been driven down from, half the country to a quarter or so. That's a huge gain in public health. That's a tribute to what public education and even scare tactics, you could say, can accomplish. Look at some of the labeling that on these cigarette packages, you know, and it's enough to scare you from smoking. Well, the government could do the same thing with guns. We could, you know, there could be a public health approach to it using the smoking model. Both are fatal. Both are within our realm of control.
Oh, Jack, I have so many follow-up questions for you, but I'm not sure listeners want a two-hour Jack pod, podcast. I mean, let us know. You want to hear Jack and I in conversation for hours on end? I mean, I definitely could ask Jack more questions, but we'll wrap up with that for today. And Jack, give us your little headline or teaser for what's going to be on the podcast next week.
I am plumb out of teasers. I just don't know what's happening, and I've got to take a moment's breath to figure it out. But I'll come up with something for sure.
Yeah. I mean, like I said last time or a couple of weeks ago, we'll be waiting in eager anticipation for next Friday, Jack. And with that, Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst, and the Ted Koppel, Walter Cronkite, Edward R. Murrow of our time, thank you as always, Jack.
Thank you very much.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.